From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This month, the air conditioning company Carrier Corporation announced it will lay off 1,200 workers in Syracuse, New York. It's one of a flood of sobering announcements from American manufacturers grappling with globalization. The developing world, too, is feeling the pain of change in a sharp-elbowed global economy. Rich nations and poor are tempted to hit the brakes. Tonight on Point, celebrated MIT economist Lester Thoreau says, no, be bold, he says, or be run over. But first, a vote on Capitol Hill that will spark a legal battle over a woman's right to end a pregnancy. By a vote of 64 to 34, the U.S. Senate today passed a bill banning the late-term abortion, or as critics call it, partial birth abortion. The ban would be the first limit on a specific type of abortion since the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision 30 years ago made abortion legal nationwide. President Bush says he will sign the bill. Sherry Stolberg is a congressional correspondent for the New York Times and joins us now from Washington. Good evening, Sherry Stolberg. Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
This vote comes 3 weeks after the House passed the same measure, Sherry. Take us through it. What exactly does the bill say?
Well, the bill, in effect, ends or would ban the procedure that critics call partial birth abortion. Doctors call this procedure intact dilation and extraction. It would make it a crime for any person to deliver a baby, and I quote here, for the purpose of performing an overt act that the person knows will kill the partially delivered living fetus. And I'm going to correct you about my name here. It's Cheryl.
Yes, of course. I'm sorry, Cheryl. Let me ask you then, this is not then a matter of the point in the pregnancy in terms of time. It's a matter of the technique required to perform the abortion that's been outlawed?
That is correct. And in fact, this bill has often been characterized as a bill that would allow late-term abortion. That is really not the case. This procedure can be used after the 12th week of pregnancy. That's not typically considered a late-term procedure. So it is a type of procedure that's being outlawed, not the time at the point of pregnancy that the procedure is being conducted.
So, Cheryl Stolberg, put this in some kind of context for us. How many or how often per year has this kind of procedure been performed? Is it routine? Is it the exception? In what circumstances is partial birth abortion pursued?
It's very difficult to get a read on that, on how often doctors are using this procedure. Good statistics aren't really kept, but it is a type of abortion procedure that doctors do say they use in certain cases when they feel that it is safe to do so for the mother, and they are very much opposed to having any kind of restriction on their right to practice medicine as they see fit. Now, abortion opponents will say this procedure is never medically necessary, it's abhorrent and grotesque and can't be allowed in a civilized society.
What are the implications for doctors who might perform this procedure if this legislation is signed and goes through?
Well, the first thing you need to know is that even if this legislation is signed and goes through, it's going to be challenged in court right away. As soon as President Bush signs it, at least three groups have vowed to file lawsuits claiming that the bill is unconstitutional because it lacks an exception for the health of the mother, and also claiming that the bill's language is so broad as to outlaw more than one type of abortion. 3 years ago, the Supreme Court rejected a similar law, one that was passed in Nebraska, on precisely these grounds. And experts say that it's likely that there will be some kind of injunction soon preventing this bill from taking effect. So the immediate effect may be no effect at all until it gets sorted out by the court.
Going straight to an injunction, you said no exemption for the health of the mother. That is, even if the pregnant woman's life were in danger, this kind of abortion would be outlawed under this legislation.
That is correct.
If this goes to court, and on those grounds or others, the court overturns the legislation, would that have the effect of cementing Roe v. Wade, making it stronger despite this attempt to chip away at it?
Well, some have argued that the courts have already settled this matter in this Nebraska case, which came up 3 years ago. But don't forget, courts are not static institutions. We have a president who would very much like to make some appointments to the Supreme Court if justices retire and allow him to do so. And so what opponents of this bill are hoping for is that by the time it reaches the United States Supreme Court, the composition of the court will have changed, and the very slim 5-4 majority that overturned this Nebraska law will be reversed, and perhaps we would see a 5-4 majority that would uphold this kind of law.
In that case, a real bite out of Roe v. Wade.
Well, obviously, if a court were to uphold this, yes, it would be a real bite out of Roe v. Wade. Now, how it would be enforced is another matter. There are certainly no cameras in doctors' operating rooms, and I presume doctors aren't going to volunteer that they're doing this kind of procedure. So unless we send federal agents into abortion clinics, it's hard to say.
But that's not beyond imagining these days. And if a doctor were found to have performed such an operation, are there penalties described under the legislation?
There are penalties. I believe the penalties include heavy fines, although the fines are not specified by the bill. And I'm sorry, I can't recall at this moment if the measure includes any kind of jail term for doctors, but I'm certain that it does include fines.
Clearly makes it a crime. Cheryl Stolberg, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Cheryl Stolberg is a congressional correspondent for the New York Times. She spoke with me from Washington. MIT economist Lester Thoreau encourages countries to embrace the global economy, but also to know it could go badly wrong and to pay attention. A weakening dollar is the most serious threat he sees. Lax intellectual property laws and enforcement abroad could wipe out whole industries. Deflation, third world poverty, and income gaps threaten too. But diving in brave, he says, is the only way to go. For fortune, says Lester Thoreau, favors the bold. So how about it? Are you feeling bold or bowled over by globalization? With job losses and a flood of imports, are you still on the bandwagon or tapping the brakes? Have you made a bundle on globalization or have you just lost your job? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio is Lester Thoreau, professor of management and economics and former dean at MIT's Sloan School of Management. His books include Fortune Favors the Bold, the new book, What We Must Do to Build a New and Lasting Global Prosperity. Good evening and welcome, Lester Thoreau.
Good to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. So here we are. You're looking out on the news with all the rest of us. IBM talking on tape, we all heard it, about sending white-collar jobs to India, manufacturing jobs fleeing the United States in enormous numbers and contributing to President Bush's problem on that front. People nervous suddenly in the U.S., the country that championed free trade so fulsomely not long ago, about the impact of globalization even here. And here comes your book saying, be bold. Is that still the message? Do you feel America's pain around globalization, Lester Thoreau?
Well, there's a lot of pain. But the thing to remember is that the trade deficit has just been slowly growing. You know, in the 1990s, we created 25 million jobs. And so far in the 21st century, we've lost 3 million jobs. But it isn't due to international trade. It's due to the fact that we had a recession and a slowly growing economy with rapid growth of productivity. Mm-hmm. And so the impact from the rest of the world, you know, it's growing, but it isn't any growing in any dramatic sense in the early 21st century. It grew just as fast in the 1990s as it is now.
So if manufacturing jobs are going overseas, you're saying don't blame it on globalization or realize that you've got more jobs because of globalization, even if some are being lost.
Well, some are certainly going to be lost. But what we were doing in the 1990s, we were creating jobs at an enormous rate. And so we didn't notice the jobs that were leaving. Mm-hmm. In the 21st century, we still have jobs leaving, but we're not creating the jobs, which gives us this net negative deficit. And the real problem, you know, 2002 is the good example. Because the economy grew at 2.4%, but productivity grew at 5.4, mm-hmm. which means you lose 3% of your jobs measured in hours of work, even though you've got a positive growth rate. Now, the other thing that happens is anytime anything happens at the moment, people say, well, it's due to some foreigner or globalization, because that's easier to say than to say, I goofed up as a manager. I'm in a dying industry. Blame it on the foreigner is certainly the easiest thing to say in these kind of circumstances.
And you can see that in the political arena right now. You hear politicians talking in those terms these days, certainly union leaders, and an awful lot of Americans who fear for their jobs or have lost their jobs. What do you think, how do you assess the American, I don't know, track record recently, Lester Thoreau, in adapting to globalization? What's your sense of how the country's doing with it? Is it handling this process? Well, you say it can't be turned back. It's going to happen. So how's the country doing?
Well, the answer is I think the fears were building up in the 1990s, but they're stronger than the 21st century simply because the economy is growing much more slowly. We were growing to 4 or 5% in the 90s. Mm-hmm. We're growing at 2.5%. In 2002-2003, and that's the real source of the problem. For example, there are 800,000 unemployed IT professionals in the United States. Those people were not unemployed because of moving jobs to India. Those people were unemployed because of the collapse of the dot-coms. Now, a few jobs have moved to India, but that's not why these 800,000 people are unemployed. But everybody points at the jobs going to India and say, that's the cause, when in the collapse of the dot-coms is the real cause.
You've grabbed my question in terms of the statistics and the numbers, but I guess I mean culturally, to the extent that we can talk about how the United States is dealing with this culturally. I mean, every country around the world, as you write, is confronted now with this dynamic. People are responding in all kinds of different ways. Some are putting on black stocking caps, you know, and going out in the street and turning over cars. Others are, in Bolivia last week, a president was thrown out. And part of the cry there was globalization is killing us peasants here.
Right. Well, the argument was they were selling gas to Mexico and the United States. It should have been used in Bolivia. It was at least the spark.
But it becomes a whipping boy, or certainly a rallying cry in terms of Americans, their state of mind, their emotions, their thinking around globalization. Do you see the country where it needs to be in terms of taking on this onslaught of change and dealing productively with it?
Oh, I have no doubt, as I say in the book, that if there was a headline in every newspaper tomorrow morning and every radio show, globalization ends, more than half the humanity would probably feel relieved. The problem is that that's not one of the options, because globalization isn't caused by governments and can't basically be stopped by governments, because what globalization is business firms, when they look for the cheapest place to make their product, where do they search? Do they search America or do they search a globe? Well, the answer is they search the globe. Same thing's true when business firms look for the most profitable place to sell their products. And, of course, we're highly integrated, and the place you can see it most clearly is 60% of our oil comes from the rest of the world, which means we've got to sell something to the rest of the world to pay for it. Mm-hmm. And if we didn't have that oil, you and I wouldn't be driving our cars, or we'd be paying $20 a gallon for gasoline.
And the companies have no choice ultimately about going to the lowest price production or the highest price place to sell, because their competitors will. So that brings the inevitability into this.
And see, the same people who complain about globalization kind of dash to Walmart to buy something made abroad they think is a penny cheaper than something made in the United States. And, of course, you can't have it both ways. You can't have cheap imports and then complain about it when something moves to the rest of the world.
As much as it's in the air lately, you write that Americans think about globalization less than anyone else in the world. Why?
Well, basically because the rest of the world sees globalization as a dangerous invasion of American culture. And we don't see it as a dangerous invasion of American culture because American culture to us is normal. And certainly if you look at the anxiety level about globalization, it's much higher outside of the United States than in the United States, even if it's getting higher as we speak.
So is or will a globalized economy be the American economy writ large across the world or something else?
No, it's going to be something else. It's going to be a new economy that we're going to build. And that's part of the reason why Americans feel a bit threatened by it, too. The rest of the world thinks we're not threatened at all because it is just the United States economy writ large. And that's one of the reasons why Americans tend to think that, too, because that's what the rest of the world yells about. But that's not what is going to happen. And we see it as if you think about those jobs that people talk about moving to China or whatever. That isn't the American economy writ large. That's changing the American economy.
In a way that will ultimately be good for the United States?
Well, it depends on who you are and what age you are, if you want the brutal truth. You know, if you're one of these people who are laid off in the current environment and you're over the age of 55, nobody should think that's good. And probably that over 55-year-old person, when they get reemployed, will get employed at a job that pays less. And there's no question that that will damage their career. On the other hand, there's also no question in the long run we can have a higher standard of living with globalization than without it.
We're talking tonight with celebrated economist Lester Thoreau about why you've got to learn to love globalization. His new book is Fortune Favors the Bold. You can join the conversation. Are you feeling bold or bowled over by globalization? Are most Americans still on the globalization bandwagon, or are they tapping the brakes? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with celebrated economist Lester Thoreau about globalization. His new book is Fortune Favors the Bold, What We Must Do to Build a New and Lasting Global Prosperity. It's all about globalization and what it's going to take to make it work and work well. You can join the conversation. Can you feel it? How has globalization affected you? Have you made a bundle? Have you lost your job? Do you believe that there's no alternative to globalization? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Lester Thoreau, you say that for all its kind of sense of rampaging inevitability, you say globalization can be shaped. In fact, you say it must be shaped. What do you mean by that?
Well, the question is to make globalization something that includes the most countries and the most people. Inevitably, there are going to be some people left out. So, you know, for example, think of two previous revolutions, the steam revolution and the electrification revolution. Tonight, 1.6 billion people out of the 6 billion people in the world will go to sleep in a house without electricity, despite the fact that the electrification revolution is over 100 years old. And the same thing is going to be true in globalization. Everybody's on the globe, but everybody's not going to be in the global economy. And, of course, the best area that kind of exemplifies that, Central Africa, because if you've got a region that's full of illiteracy, no infrastructure, no physical safety, businesses simply don't do business there. And Africa is left out, and Africa has a falling per capita income. On the other hand, if you look at a country that participates, and, of course, the big participator is China, China wouldn't be growing at its current growth rate if it couldn't make products and sell them in the wealthy industrial world. And so it's not so easy as to say first world versus third world, because it's more complicated than that. You've got a third world country, China, that's a great success. You've got a third world area, Central Africa, that's a great failure. If you look at the first world, you know, in if you take the 7 years from 1995 to 2002, 60% of the increase of the GDP of the entire world was inside the United States. Globalization has been phenomenally good for the United States in the last 7 years, despite the current complaints.
So part of it is, in your view, getting everybody or as many as possible on board so that they're not ultimately left out. Though.
Yeah, see, globalization doesn't crush anybody. It leaves them out. Just like, you know, electricity doesn't crush anybody. You just don't have it and you don't get all the benefits of having it.
We'll come back and talk about the effect of globalization. You know, of course, that's debated and sometimes debated in the streets with rocks, but there seems to me to be more to your notion of shaping globalization than just making it inclusive. You write, from the peak of the Roman Empire to the bottom of the Dark Ages, standards of living went down 90%. Cities essentially disappeared. Illiterate societies replaced what had been literate societies. Humans sometimes get on the wrong track. You say, if globalization is a step in the wrong direction, the responsibility is ours. We will have made it so because we did not build the right global economy. Gosh, the stakes sound terrible there. What's the right global economy?
Well, one of the things is you've got to have an enormous push on education, because at the same time we're gluing globalization, we're shifting from an industrial to a knowledge-based economy. And so the big pressure has, and both in the third world and in the first world, has to be making sure that everybody's educated so they can basically participate. And then there are things we can do to make sure that more of the third world does participate than is currently participating.
You also, around this shaping issue, you point to some real pitfalls here. In particular, and this took me by surprise a bit, but you write about the possibility of a weakening dollar, enormous U.S. imports, enormous trade deficits, ultimately leading to a kind of loss of confidence in the U.S. dollar with a kind of terrible flow-through repercussions for the world economy.
You've got two currencies at the moment. The one is undervalued and one's overvalued. The overvalued one's the United States. We're running a trade deficit, a huge one, over $550 billion this year. No country can run a trade deficit forever. And at some point it ends. And when it does end, it's one of those earthquakes that kind of occurs in the United States, but the damage is in the rest of the world, because it will, when the value of the dollar goes down, we will cure our trade deficit.
Slow down on that just a little bit. The value would go down because the trade deficit becomes so large that other countries no longer believe in the dollar?
The other country, in order to run a trade deficit, the rest of the world has to, we use the word lend, but it really is lend and invest. Mm-hmm. The rest of the world has to be willing to move capital into the United States. Mm-hmm. And if they're not willing to do that, the value of the dollar falls. And when the value of the dollar falls, you, the American, simply can't afford to buy foreign goods because they're 40% more expensive. So you don't take the foreign vacation. You don't buy the Mercedes. You don't buy the Toyota.
And Walmart's not full of clothes made in China?
And Walmart's not full of clothes made in China, but it's full of clothes that are more, because those Chinese clothes have become more expensive.
So they're there, but they just won't be the bargains
they
that
won't
they
be
were.
The bargains that they are.
And so people don't buy as many, so the factories in China don't have work to do.
They shut down. You know, we import 3 million cars. You know, the estimates are that it would take about a 40% fall in the value of the dollar to cure our trade deficit. So imported cars would have to be 40% more expensive. Now, at 40% more expensive, we wouldn't buy many of those 3 million cars, which means those factories and the rest of the world shuts down. Now, in the United States, we would produce more cars, but we would have a lower standard of living because cars would be more expensive.
And the follow-through of all that is kind of lights going off on globalization, kind of global recession and depression.
It's a global recession that hits the rest of the world even harder than it does the United States. And that's the kind of thing that could blow up the kind of cooperation necessary to make globalization work.
I'd say so. You make a pretty big noise about it in this book. Do you see that as a real and present danger?
Well, it's one of those, you know, in this sense, economics is like geology. You know, the geologists know exactly how the world works. It's called plate tectonics. We know exactly where the San Andreas Fault is in California. Mm-hmm. And we know there will be a big earthquake there, but we don't know when. Is it 1 second from now or 1,000 years from now? The same thing's true on the trade deficit and the value of the dollar. That problem is going to get solved at some point. It could be in the distant future. It could be close. It could be quick. It could be slow. But it will be solved because this is not economics. It's simply mathematics that you can't run a big trade deficit forever because as you're accumulating debt, you've got to pay interest on the debt. You've got to pay interest on the interest. And that's called compound interest. And no human being has ever run faster than compound interest.
So when you talk about shaping globalization, is part of what you're talking about managing deficits like this, deficits so they don't run the world economy off a cliff?
Absolutely. And part of it's also managing a financial crisis in the third world so it doesn't run third world countries off the cliff.
That's supposed to be World Bank, IMF.
That's World Bank, IMF. And it's one of the reasons why in the book I suggest some reforms for both the World Bank and the IMF.
Such as?
Well, basically, I think what we ought to do on the IMF is make it an agency that's much like in the United States, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, where it looks at countries before there's a crisis. Mm-hmm. And if it certifies their policies as sound and then they have a crisis, it simply lends them the necessary money. What we do now is we wait until there's a crisis and then the IMF kind of steps in almost as a colonial power and tries to run the country. And they can't do that because they don't have the political leverage and they don't have the knowledge to kind of run the country at that point in time. And most of the damage in the third world from these financial crises is done in the recovery period, not in the crisis itself.
Lester Thoreau, the title of the book is Fortune Favors the Bold. And you're saying that it's the confident who will ultimately succeed in globalization. Why? I mean, the confident, I guess, always succeed at one level. But what is it about this turn of the wheel?
Well, see, globalization is connected with a whole series of technical revolutions. The information revolution may be the most dramatic. Biotechnology may be the most fundamental. But the question is, are you willing to use these new technologies? And see, I use these comparisons with the past. Some countries were willing to do the steam engine and some weren't. Mm-hmm. The ones who were willing to use the steam engine became rich. The one who weren't didn't. The same thing is true of electrification. Some people were willing to use electrification. Some weren't. The ones who were became rich. And this is a revolution which some will leap into and they will become rich. And some won't, and they will basically stay where they were and become relatively poor, just as we've seen over the last 200 years with both steam and electrification.
Is the U.S. leaping in so far?
So far, the United States and China are the two big leapers and the two big winners. And see, it's very important to remember the thing I mentioned earlier, that 60% of the GDP of the entire world in the last 7 years has been added in the United States. We're not losers. We're winners.
However it feels when your job goes away. We're talking tonight with Lester Thoreau, economist and author of the new book, Fortune Favors the Bold. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Guy's calling from Miami, Florida. Hi, Guy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi, Mr. Thoreau, it seems to me that you, that when you made that comment, I mean, I had to dial the phone right away, that the same people that worry about globalization also rush out to Walmart to pay a reduced price for their products just completely conflates the notion of, you know, voting politically and, you know, in buying something and making a personal choice to maximize your personal utility. When somebody votes, they're trying to decide what kind of society they want. When somebody goes out and buys something, they're making a choice about how they can maximize the utility based on their opportunity cost. You should know that.
So, Guy, are you saying, do we hear in Guy from Miami an opponent of globalization, and why?
Indeed.
Why?
Well, I mean, I sort of believed Mr. Thoreau when he talked about the zero-sum game economy and talked about, you know, I don't know how long ago that was, but I remember.
20 years, yeah.
Yeah. I actually believe it, and I believe that no matter how hard, I don't know, China or India might decide that they want to be participants in the global economy, that there's still only so much stuff to go around, and these are ultimately political choices about how we want to distribute resources. And in as much as we turn it over to the marketplace, we're making the same mistake that this country did back in the Lochner days, I guess I'll call it, when Justice Holmes chastised the Supreme Court for adopting the social statics of Mr. Herbert Spencer. That sounds to me really what Mr. Thoreau would like to do with the whole globe, and we had to prevent that by taking political control of the economy.
Guys, stick with us here. I want to get Lester Thoreau's response, but stay with us.
No, I think you can make a distinction between what you buy and how you vote, no question. But there's also the issue that people are schizophrenic. The political decision you would like them to make is a decision that would raise the price of what they pay in Walmart, which they wouldn't like. And if they knew that connection, they probably wouldn't vote that way.
But Guy is saying he clearly doesn't like the impact of globalization. He wants to make it a political decision and says, you know, the way people vote with their dollars is not just about the efficiency of the market. The market may not be the way he wants to shape the society he lives in. Others may feel the same way. Is that an option to determine the shape of our societies politically in the future, or is it really all surrendered to economic dynamics?
No. I argue in the book, if a country wants to pull out of globalization, they can. But they have to understand that when they do that, they're basically, it's like pulling out of electrification. You're basically saying, I'm going to step aside, I'm going to let the rest of the world advance, and I'm not going to advance with them.
Guy, do you see stepping out of globalization as consigning your country or another country to, you know, backwoods?
No, Professor Thoreau he just contradicted himself. He said that he understands that there's a difference between making a political choice and making a personal choice about how you maximize your utility based on whatever, you know, set of choices you have and making a political choice. And yet he says that people are schizophrenic. They're not schizophrenic at all. They're answering two separate questions that have completely separate ramifications and sets of outcomes.
But Guy, Lester Thoreau describes it as a kind of choice here, either get on the bandwagon or, you know, be left in the bush as things move ahead.
Beg your pardon?
Either get on the bandwagon or be left out in the weeds as the global economy goes forward.
We are the bandwagon. This is the United States of America. We're 25% of the global economy. If we decide that we want to change the way the bandwagon is moving, we can. We can make political choices to do that. Mr. Thoreau is being intellectually dishonest by saying that these are mystic choices this is sort of a mystic state of being.
So you think the United States could drag a foot out of the globalization car here and slow it down and change it?
Well, I'm not completely comfortable with those sorts of simplistic metaphors
Okay, put it in your terms, Guy. What are you suggesting?
What Mr. Herbert Spencer, to repeat myself, would consider to be the natural state of being is not necessarily the optimal state of being, and I think that we proved that decades ago, in the early part of the last century, and I'm afraid that many economists just didn't learn that lesson.
Guy, we've got it. Thanks for your call. Lester Thoreau, you hear the unease here, the intellectual pushback, the emotional pushback. This is a citizen who doesn't want his world, the world, shaped by the economy, you know, nature untamed, whatever you want to call it.
Well, I think he's got a lot of company. And if I were President Bush, I would be very worried about people like the voter, because if you've lost 3 million jobs, as we have since President Bush became president, it's got to look bad on your records, and it may mean that you don't get reelected. So there's no question there's a lot of anxiety, and there's even more in the rest of the world than there is in the United States. No question about that.
But are you absolutely confident, in spite of that, that this is the way things are going to go? I mean, you know, French farmers don't like it, and you can go on and on with the list. Is there, and even people who accept it and maybe play in the game, you know, must sometimes feel like, my gosh, we're lashed onto this merry-go-round. It's going faster and faster. Is this really the way things have to go? Is there the option of a considered human decision to go on down this road or not? Or is it, as Guy suggests, are you saying, is it your case that something about nature just pushes the world this way?
Well, technology is pushing it this way. Because with information communication technologies, for the first time, you can actually run a factory in China and make things for the American market. You couldn't do that 20 years ago or 200 years ago. And so there's a tremendous technology push in this direction. And the other institutional push is obviously global corporations. Because we're, every day on Wall Street, we're saying to global corporations, you've got to meet expectations in terms of profits. And the only way you can do that is to do things abroad. And for example, General Electric, they have a policy that they want to do 70% outsourcing from the rest of the world. Mm. Now, you could say they could make a political decision to do something different, but you're going to have to organize a very different society in order to have them make that very different decision.
Paul is calling from Burlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Paul, you're on the air.
Hi. I was just responding to the earlier point. I think Mr. Thoreau had said that we didn't notice that when the jobs left in the 1990s because they were replaced by other jobs, but it seems to me that people who lost manufacturing jobs noticed that they were replaced by low-income service jobs, and their average incomes went down and their health insurance went away. So it seemed like a little bit of a simplistic statement that we didn't notice the jobs leaving.
Well, at the same time, we created a whole set of good jobs in the dot-coms, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, in the 1990s, the average income of the average American went up.
Maybe I have my facts wrong, but I thought over 15 years or 20 years or something that a large portion of the middle class has actually lost purchasing power. They weren't working in dot-coms. They were the people who lost purchasing power. Maybe my facts are wrong.
You're absolutely right. They didn't lose purchasing power, but if you take the last 15 years, basically the people in the middle held even or went up slightly, but not a lot. Most of the gains in the economy were people in the top one-third of the income distribution.
And there's a sense that Paul is speaking to, Lester Thoreau, of a lot of people losing jobs that had some status, that had decent wages, that had a kind of skill, even if it's not the skill that the economy wants from them right now, that got shunted down to poor jobs.
Well, but see, this is one of those places where the previous caller's comments are right. We can make political decisions about how we do health insurance and how do we do pensions. And the United States is the only country in the world that it says your health insurance is associated with the job you have.
So when you say globalization can be shaped, is that part of what you're saying?
That's part of it, right.
We've got to – we can build an envelope around this
– you can, as I very clearly say in the book, you can have social welfare policies. They've got to be designed different and financed differently. For example, you cannot have a health insurance system where in the United States your health insurance depends on the job you have, while in the rest of the world companies don't pay for health insurance because health insurance comes from the government. You can have good pension systems, but they have to be financed with value-added taxes as opposed to payroll taxes because companies will go to those countries where you don't have payroll taxes. And we see that just to some extent benefiting the United States. Mercedes and BMWs built factories in Alabama and South Carolina in the 1990s to get away from German payroll taxes, principally.
It was cheaper to build in the United States.
Cheaper in the United States, and good jobs moved to the United States in the automobile industry.
And yet, everybody longs for a buffer when things cut the other way. We're talking tonight with Lester Thoreau. His new book is Fortune Favors the Bold, What We Must Do to Build a New and Lasting Global Prosperity. Does America have more to gain or more to lose than the rest of the world? Lester Thoreau says globalization can be shaped. How would you like to shape it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with celebrated MIT economist Lester Thoreau about why you've got to learn to love globalization, whether it feels good today or not. What do you think? Are you feeling bold or bowled over by globalization? Lester Thoreau's new book is Fortune Favors the Bold. Is that you? Are most Americans still on the globalization bandwagon, or are you tapping the brakes? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tom's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It seems to me that it's a daunting enough task to increase trade among very similar economies like the EU. It just seems to me ridiculous. I mean, in some sense, to ever talk about any sort of real level playing field between, say, the U.S. economy and a sub-Saharan African economy. I mean, they're far more dissimilar than they are similar.
Does it have to be a level playing field to benefit both sides, Tom?
But if it's not level, then, you know, you have these problems of, in this country, creating a race to the bottom, pushing our standards down. And then you have over there dumping of U.S. goods on them, some of which they need, but they also prevent them from developing their own internal markets. And if you look at the
like history, the famous subsidized cotton and its cousins.
But if you look at the history of developing countries that have become rich, like China and India and even Japan after World War II, they were actually very protectionist. And that's how they developed their internal domestic markets.
Tom, stand by. Let's get Lester Thoreau in on this. Lester Thoreau, you said it yourself. In the 90s, the United States benefited overwhelmingly from globalization, 65% of that benefit coming here. If you're a poor country looking out on this scene, and there are still trade barriers, and there are still subsidies, does it look like globalization is working? Or?
Well, let's be clear on which poor country we're talking about. China has a per capita GNP of $875. That's a poor country. China is benefiting enormously.
It beats Benin.
Yeah, sub-Saharan Africa, which is parts of which is wealthier than China in terms of per capita income, is not benefiting. There are a whole set of reasons. One reason is China is much better educated. It has better standards of safety and a whole set of other things which Central Africa doesn't have. But at the same time, see, we have one sector where we're not moving to globalization at all. It is, in fact, agriculture. And in agriculture, you see all the problems of not moving to globalization, because what we're doing is we're saying, well, we got to keep that cotton farmer in the southern part of the United States in business, so we give him a big subsidy, which means that that little cotton farmer in Africa can't sell his product.
So what about those countries in this jet speed change here? I mean, Tom points out, and he's right, Asian countries, which are held up as the model, the poster children for economic development, did that under big shields of protectionism. What about countries that don't have the same
Japan
option?
Japan did it under a big shield of protectionism. It isn't quite right to say that everybody did it under
a big
shield.
Well, not necessarily, but Korea had plenty, Taiwan had plenty, Singapore had plenty.
Well, I'm not sure Singapore really had any protection at all. It was too small to have any effective protection.
But you take my point. Look at the tigers, and a lot of them had plenty. China, even to this day.
China's protection to this day is basically a very undervalued currency, which gives them an enormous cost advantage.
What about it? You prescribe to sub-Saharan Africa open markets?
In the book, I'm not saying just open markets. That's part of shaping globalization. But if you take agriculture, that's a place where we need more open markets. And Cancun collapsed because you couldn't have a deal unless the First World was willing to quit protecting agriculture. It wasn't. You couldn't get a deal on services, which the First World wants, because the Third World wasn't going to do that unless they could have a deal on agriculture. And what we really lost was a deal on intellectual property rights.
We'll talk about that in a second. But to Tom's point, then, this doesn't happen in a friction-free environment. Politics and big power come into the picture.
Right.
So can you realistically be so sanguine about this for that poor country when the dice are kind of loaded here, aren't they?
No, but see, I don't think in the book I am sanguine about everybody, because I say some are going to be left out, both as individuals and as countries. And the question is, what can you do to include the most? What I am saying is you can't stop it. You can shape it, but you can't stop it. Basically, because it's just like you can't reject electricity and say we're not going to do it. Some countries have done that, and they're poor because that's what the decision they made. They were able to basically not electrify, but because they made that decision, they're still poor today.
But this mixes up. I mean, some may have made a decision. Others you're describing right now being cut off from the progress they might make by big tariffs or by agricultural tariffs. Meanwhile, the whole train rushes ahead, and are people really going to slow down long enough to make the kind of adjustments, do the kind of shaping that you describe?
Well, see, I think we're slowing down at the moment, and that's one of the things that happened at Cancun, because basically we've moved to a system that's very close to free trade in agricultural products. At the same time, we've moved to a system that's the complete opposite of free trade in agricultural products, with bigger and bigger subsidies and bigger and bigger protection.
You're saying we're close to free trade in which?
Manufacturing products,
right. But the big countries haven't figured that out, and maybe no one's figured it out on the ag side. Tom, thanks for your call. Andrew's calling from Detroit. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much, and I appreciate you appreciate the conversation. It's a good one. My basic question is this: a little bit of context. As an entrepreneur and an employer of at one time supporting about 30 families,
In what industry?
Supplier to the automotive industry.
Okay.
That industry has been beset by problems, and has also been, of course, a big proponent of globalization at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of displacement. What basic strategic, you know, moves or generic strategies should entrepreneurial businesses such as mine, which is at one point was a creator of jobs, now we're losing jobs. What are we going to have to do to be competitive in the future? What basic strategies do we have to look at? One of the ones we're looking at, of course, is getting out of the automotive business.
Which is pretty drastic, but stick with us, Andrew. Lester Thoreau, here's a man, an entrepreneur. He was creating jobs. Globalization, kind of the whiplash hit him, and he doesn't know how to do it now.
There are two answers. One, there needs to be a change in two currencies. One is the American dollar, and the other is the Chinese currency. The other answer is the question is, can you find a technology niche to play the game? For example, people use these micro devices to replace gyroscopes in airbags, those kind of things. And so there are lots of places for technology in the automobile industry. But at the same time, you've got these very fundamental forces of an overvalued dollar and an undervalued Chinese currency, which makes it very hard for an entrepreneur to face up to that. And basically managing those currencies is part of what shaping globalization is about.
Andrew, can you hop out there and become an expert in gyroscopes, employ 30 more heads of families on that technology?
We're actually going across into a different industry. We're looking at the regulation of the automotive industry and the heavy engineering content of the automotive industry and a lot of other characteristics of that industry, and we're both buying expertise and building expertise in medical products, of all things.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, automobiles, I think, is a good example of globalization because two things have happened at the same time. Some parts manufacturing has certainly moved abroad. On the other hand, you've got a whole series of global automobile companies that have opened up factories in the United States, Mercedes, BMW, Toyota, Honda, Nissan. And so we are making a lot of cars in the United States by companies that we think of as foreign companies. The globalization is the automobile industry, just a perfect example of globalization where you get all kinds of movement back and forth. Some things leaving, some things coming.
Andrew, good luck with your entrepreneurship there. But Lester Thoreau, this brings up this whole kind of dynamic that you can't help but wonder about. Whether the globalized economy's demands become so great, its speed becomes so great, its consequences of things moving become so drastic that people just can't keep up with them and lead humane lives. I mean, you described how auto manufacturing coming to the U.S. from Germany because Germany's costs were too high. Well, they were too high because they had those kinds of buffers that kept people on good unemployment for a long time if they needed it and so on. I mean, does this really drive the quality of life to a better place ultimately, or does it make everything so, you know, lightning speed and slippery that nobody can ever settle down and enjoy life?
Well, but you got to remember that globalization is partly your cell phone. It's partly the Internet. A whole set of things
which
that we
are
do
nice, but they also keep you working 24 hours a day.
That's true too. They change what life is,
but
and how we do it.
Well, but, that kind of glosses over it, doesn't it? I mean, do you have any concern about that? Can a humane life, as we've understood it, and granted, 300 years ago it was different again, but can life be humane and good and globalized?
See, if you think of those, as I very clearly point out, if you any of those social welfare benefits that you want to have, you can have.
Well, Germany had them, and the cars are being built in Alabama.
But the answer is you can't finance them with a payroll tax. You got to finance them with in the long run, I think governments will collect two taxes. They will collect personal income taxes and a value-added tax. You can collect a personal income tax because you know where the person is.
Mm-hmm.
And a value-added tax has the benefit you levy it on imports and subtract it from exports so it doesn't affect international prices.
You think countries can afford to buffer the impact?
Yes, absolutely. Anybody who says you have to collapse the social welfare state because of globalization just wrong. You don't have to do that.
Boy, take it from Lester Thoreau, but there's a lot of catching up to do at the speed that globalization is traveling.
And you need a different tax system than the one we have at the moment, and that's part of acting to shape globalization.
I'm just hearing right around the sphere of globalization as you describe it, all these things that would be nice, that would make it more comfortable, that would make it more equitable, and they don't seem like they're keeping up with the train. Justin's calling from Boston. Hi, Justin. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Great, thanks.
I have a question for Mr. Thoreau.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to get his opinion on what the effects of would be on the American and global economy if the U.S. Refused to trade with countries that didn't adopt minimum wage and labor laws, because it seems to me that that would, if they did do that, then perhaps we would have more equitability in terms of, because the wages would be higher over there, so our workers would be able to compete more easily.
Right. So could that be laid down? Could that scheme be laid down? Justin, thanks for your call. It's a very current issue, of course.
Right.
Gephardt on the campaign trail talking about this, a global minimum wage, global labor laws, pie in the sky, or can that be part of shaping globalization?
The answer is yes or no. You can't do a global minimum wage. You can do some global labor regulations. For example, there's no reason why you can't have a global law basically outlawing child labor, outlawing slavery, outlawing unsafe practices, because everybody has an interest in doing that. But you have some very poor countries and some very rich countries, and they're poor because their productivity is low. And you can't legislate an American minimum wage for a country that has a per capita income of $200.
And yet that's on the political agenda now. I mean, Dick Gephardt's talking about it. What do you make of that as an economist who knows American politics?
Well, you know, that is something that I would basically call pandering, because it may be very attractive to Americans to talk about it, but just not something that's physically possible. On the other hand, you can focus on things that are real, like child labor. Child labor is in nobody's interest, including the countries where it occurs, and there's no reason why you can't get an international agreement and put it in your trade agreements.
But there's been pushback even on that. You know what happened in Bangladesh when child labor comes up? They say, no, we need child labor. This is part of our way forward. You can't deprive us of this first rung on the ladder.
But that's where you can make a distinction and say you draw the line at that point. Because what you can say to Bangladesh, which is in fact true, is in the long run, child labor is not in your self-interest. And see, we didn't abolish child labor in the United States because we just got richer. We abolished it because we woke up one day and said, hey, it doesn't work, because if you have child labor, kids don't get educated, which means in the long run, you don't have an educated society.
You need them in school.
You need them in schools where you need them, not on the job.
So, Lester Thoreau, if this globalized economy is coming on, and if it's not going to look like the U.S. economy writ large, what will it look like?
Probably the truthful answer is none of us really know, because it's going to be developed, and it'll partly depend on what we do. But it'll be an economy where everything's a lot more integrated, and I think, you know, the caller that called from the automobile industry is a perfect illustration, where some things are moving abroad, parts manufacturing, assemblies moving to the United States, and it's a very complicated interaction. Just in today's New York Times, there was talk about college students who were buying their textbooks from England because they were cheaper than buying the same textbook in the United States. That's part of globalization, where you can buy a book on the other side of the world and have it shipped to you in 24 hours.
Or drugs in Canada. If it's going to be shaped, can it be shaped by national governments, or does that require some kind of stronger international governance?
Well, it's going to require international agreements, which means national governments can play a role in it, but they can't essentially dictate what the global economy is going to look like.
And boldness, how far does it go? Why bold? Just because it's scaring the living daylights out of everybody?
Basically because one of the things you have to do in this kind of world is you have to take some risks and you have to take some chances and you have to be bold, because nobody knows exactly what's going to work. And I'll give you an example. Take eBay, which is the most profitable firm on the Internet. I think anybody, certainly myself, who looked at that business model 15 years ago said that isn't going to work. We said two things. First of all, it's too easy to copy. Somebody else will have an auction. And secondly, it'll quickly collapse because Americans aren't honest and they won't deliver the goods they promise. Well, we're wrong. One year, the biggest auction, nobody wants to go to a little auction, and 99.9% of Americans deliver.
So and bold, bold, and they're winning.
And they're winning. Now, on the other hand, there were some things that looked awfully good that failed, and ahead of time, you just don't know.
Lester Thoreau, it's quite a picture you paint out there. We're going to have to read this and be heartened by it. To be bold. A lot to be done. Lester Thoreau, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Lester Thoreau's new book is Fortune Favors the Bold, What We Must Do to Build a New and Lasting Global Prosperity. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.